Hi, everyone. It's Mary Lou Tyler. This week, I have a guest who I actually found David on the internet. He wrote an article, and John Barrows, who's a colleague of mine, stuck it up on LinkedIn, and that's how I got to know David Premer. And he is the founder of Cerebral Selling out of Canada. He is an amazing person. And I don't say that just because he's an engineer like I am, but when I read his article, I realized, wow, there's someone out there who really has thought about this whole state of selling, where we are. So I asked him to come on the show today. He has a ton of topics he can talk about because he specializes in the entire pipeline. But we really want to focus today on the education pieces of top of funnel. And he's going to share with us his views on where things are going and how we can really better our knowledge, our profession, and get away from this sea of sameness, as he calls it. So, David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Mary Lou. It's great to be here. That was a great intro. Wow.
Yeah, well, you're a great guy.
My goodness. Thank you so much.
So, you know, we chatted offline about the topic and you're spot on. We really want to talk about, you know, where we are with the current state of selling, the education pieces. You know, I have this conversation with my kids all the time because one of them asked, you know, why do we need to go to college, Mom, when everything's out there for us to learn? And yes, everything's out there to learn, but the problem is there's so much information there that people are just really getting way overwhelmed at what's there. So can you share with us your views on what the state of selling is and in terms of the education side of things, you know, kind of point us in the direction of where we should be looking so that we can get out of this sea of sameness?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of nuance to the current state of sales. And you know, part of the challenge in a way is that we're so plugged in, right? Like we're so plugged in, we're in the sea of information. Mm-hmm. And yet we are also stuck in the sea of sameness. We, you know, as we plug in, very little out there becomes differentiated to us anymore. You know, it used to be there were only a few vendors in every, you know, kind of major functional area. And now there are literally thousands that are, you know, let's say to some extent differentiated from one another, but everyone says the same thing. You know, if I were to go into a, you know, give a talk and say, oh, all right, here's a bunch of value propositions. We reduce cycle times, we improve efficiency, and we improve conversion rates, and we improve customer satisfaction, and we reduce churn. You know, how many of our vendors does that cover? And the answer would be most, right?
Right.
We all tend to say the same thing. And yet, you know, attention spans are very, very short. So the question is, well, now, you know, the game has changed. Now we have to devise different tactics. And what tends to happen is that companies tend to come back with, oh, you know what, the stuff that I was doing before to be successful isn't working. And, you know, they're looking for, you know, that new approach. So that's mm-hmm. kind of one of the biggest things that's changed on the just on the environment side. And then you guessed about why the education front. I know it's mm-hmm. a big focus for you.
Big focus. And you know, the thing that I like what you mentioned up front about the value prop, I have been spending the last month trying to figure out almost like a puzzle, you know, putting together a game, so to speak, of how to create a value prop that's differentiated. And it's really hard to find a set of tools and get the students in a mindset so that they know which variables to sort of pull from the plethora of marketing collateral that's out there in their company or competitor landscapes or website research to be able to pull in areas where they think they can be distinctive and unique and different. What advice do you have for people who are swimming in that sea? How do they, like, what's step one of trying to figure out where they should look for differentiation?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan. So I do a lot of reading, as I'm sure you do. And one of my favorite books is Dan Pink's book, To Sell as Human. And in that book, he talks about a concept called clarity, which I found, you know, exists in all of these well-differentiated areas of sales and marketing. So clarity just really is all about helping your target customer understand what it is that you do and the value that you can add very quickly. And oftentimes in our typical pitches, we start talking about how we've added more RAM and more ROM and we're made of aluminum and all these kinds of things. And we just sound the same as everyone else. And so where I like to start with is that point of clarity. What is the specific problem you solve? Get really good. If you were to meet someone at a party and they were to say, Mary Lou, what is it that you do? Right. And, it, you know, we're kind of asking that question, half not caring what the other person has to say. Right. So get really good at answering that question. So Dan Pink is a real master at this. Simon Sinek has a ton of content on this. And I try as much as I can to kind of stand on the shoulders of these giants and kind of post some content to my my site as well about how to really get to the core of the problem that you solve. But there's lots of ways. There's starting really with the core value proposition. You know, the business tangible value that you add, because that's what really people care about. They don't care about how you do it as much. They care about later on how. They start with the why and they start with like, what's the value? And just starting with that, you know, point of clarity can really, really help cut through the noise for people.
The other thing that I remember reading somewhere, I read like you, I read a lot. I read something about a research project where they were looking to find what items separated one vendor from another. And the number one thing they came up with was something called overt benefit, which is like what's in it for the customer or the client. And it's not feature based. It's really you have to just find this direct path of the overwhelming benefit that you provide that no one else has articulated or articulated in a way that the client or the customer can differentiate you in his head. And they always give us consumer examples, you know, when they talk about minty fresh toothpaste versus whitening toothpaste. So there's an adjective that seems to describe the differences. Have you found that there are like building blocks where people can start looking, and like overt benefit being one? Are there other things that they can look at to be able to start to synthesize what these blocks are for differentiation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my most favorite, I should say, maybe even guilty pleasures is infomercials. I love infomercials. Not that I buy a lot of stuff off infomercials, but I love the pitch. I love watching the Shopping Channel. I love to hear how people string together these pitches. And one of the things that these programs do in order to differentiate themselves in a very early stage in their conversation with the buyer is they cut them. If I can kind of pull that through for a second. The idea is, you know, if you're going to sell someone a Band-Aid, there's three ways to sell them a Band-Aid. You can look for people who have cuts and sell them a Band-Aid. You can look for people who are afraid of getting cuts and sell them a Band-Aid. Or you can cut people and you can sell them a Band-Aid. Now, I'm not suggesting we go out and intentionally harm anyone, right? But the idea is, you know, you're watching these infomercials. And let's say, for example, there's one for, you know, those knives that can kind of cut through shoe leather. And how do they start off? Do you know how those, you know what I'm talking about? You know those infomercials start off? How do they start off?
I don't remember. I'm not a TV watcher, so I think the last infomercial I watched is probably in the 80s.
Well, these infomercials are timeless. It's the same product. But you think about so how do they, well, I'm going to show you this sharp set of knives. I can cut through anything. I am going to start out with some black and white grainy footage of someone trying to cut a tomato. With a horrible knife that's dull. The tomato splatters all over everything. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's an example. Now, you might be watching that show, not even thinking to yourself, but you know what I need? I need a really sharp set of knives. But all of a sudden, you're watching this and they've done a great job of creating some pain. They have cut you. Now you're thinking, yes, that is me. My goodness. Okay. Tell me, what is your solution? You know, the knife gods. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is we can, now I'm not, again, suggesting we go and intentionally cut anyone, but oftentimes in our business and in our personal lives, we kind of walk around with this layer of protection around us, right? We need that layer of protection and insulation. Otherwise, all the messages of the world would inundate us and we'd just be completely overwhelmed. But every now and then, if you can go out with a message that is piercing, that talks about a specific pain that resonates with people, right? You cut them a little bit first, then you're going to be in great shape. I'll give you just a very simple example. For many years, Yesware, who does, you know, they do like email tracking, had a slogan on their website. I don't know if they have it anymore. But the thing on their website said, do you want to know what happens after you click send? And that's a good example of cutting someone. Like, oh my gosh, you know what? I hadn't thought about what happens after I click send. I do want to know, but I don't. Okay, yes, where gods, tell me. What is it that you can help me with, right? So I love this idea of quote-unquote cutting people.
That's great. Yeah, I you know, in my when I'm teaching clients and students how to write emails, we're looking for what I call triggers. And, you know, what you just mentioned was a curiosity trigger, because you're like, oh, I'm curious. I've never thought about it. I wonder what the result is. And then this whole thing about contrasting, you know, before and after, old world to new world. Those are the elements, I think, from an emotional standpoint, that we need to grab attention from people at top of funnel, especially, in order to get them to at least stop what they're doing and notice us, you know. And that's an art in itself. But there are certain triggers that work with certain audiences. And the other thing that I had to really learn the hard way is that our ideas don't have to really hit the entire market. We need to really segment down to a size of accounts and industries where these messages would resonate more so. And then once we build that momentum, then we can use social proof of others who have come before our prospects who have been successful by using our product or service to get the results they want. So, but it has to start somewhere where you're really, like you said, you're really looking to give them an idea that they hadn't thought of before, or twist it in some fashion so it takes on a new life of its own. But boy, having put that pressure on salespeople to come up with what those things are is really tough. Really tough.
It's true. Well, there are definitely, I say, like layers of degree, if I'm going to use an Olympic diving term, like degrees of difficulty of, yeah. of putting together those kinds of pitches. So yeah, sometimes coming up with a really good pain-laced, you know, introductory statement can be challenging. But I think what you just mentioned, this idea of the exclusionary principle, is actually quite powerful. And it's something that not only do I teach, but I have used a lot in my own personal experience as a sales leader. Even to the extent, you know, imagine, you know, people think about having on their website, you know, hey, look, it's an accounting package for people who don't know anything about accounting. You know, like there's a bit of an exclusionary principle there. But also in your sales collateral, I mean, we used to have in a bunch of our companies, and I've done 4 startups, we used to have slides in our collateral that used to say, this isn't for everybody.
Right.
You know, and people would lean in, we're like, hold on a second. Like, aren't you supposed to, you're in sales. What do you mean you're not for everybody? Right. But that exclusionary principle, I mean, it's amazing because it helps customers self-select. It also puts you as a seller in what I call the ultimate mindset to do discovery, which is eliminated, is that of the healthy skeptic, which is, it helps you eliminate that, the cognitive bias that we have. It's like, if I'm going out on a dream date with Mary Lou, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, she could be the one. Mary Lou could be the one, right? And I get all excited. And then so when I'm on my date with Mary Lou, I start looking for evidence that she's the one,
right,
rather than going and saying, hey, you know what? I hope this date goes really well, but she's probably not the one, but I'm going to keep an open mind, right? Like the two are very different. So that's actually something very easy when you think about top of the funnel. What can you do? Think about who you're, to your point, think about who you're for and be exclusionary. This isn't for everyone.
One of my most successful emails of late, I borrowed from a gentleman out of UK, Phil M. Jones is his name. And he wrote a book about what to say, exactly what to say, I think it is. And he had a phrase in there that said, I'm not sure if it's for you, but so I tried that in some of our cold emails, and it's that exclusionary thing. I don't think it's for you, but if it is, or but I might, you know, there may be a way that we can help you solve a problem. It got a lot of interest because people are naturally wanting to be included in the group. Even they need to know what's not for them. You know, what is it that we think is not for them?
So. That's right. Well, I think what you said is there's a nuance to what you said as well. It's partially being exclusionary, but then partially saying, I don't know yet. You might be a good fit. I don't know. You know, we need to have a conversation first. Right. And so you're intriguing them with the possibility of them being a good fit. And then, you know, now they're willing to spend the time.
And then really asking their permission, you know, when would be a good time for you to take a proper look at this?
That's right.
all those little things like that, just twisting those words and understanding human behavior. I think it's all coming down to, David, is that salespeople today have really got to not only know their products and features inside and out. So if you get shook at 3 a.m, you could tell us all the benefits of a potential feature and the results that people are going to get. You know, that has to be ingrained in your DNA. But also now we're really seeing that differentiation is really a good understanding, a working understanding of human behavior.
Absolutely. My goodness. It's never been more important. I mean, you know, Dan Pink, not to, you know, again, to stand on the shoulders of giants, mm-hmm. but this idea that sales has become, and this is part of my ethos for starting Cerebral Selling, is that sales has become, if it wasn't before, a thinking person's profession. You know, yeah. It's really drilling down, which is why I think, you know, we have two engineers here on the phone talking about this, but it's really about understanding the why. You know, why do people buy things and how do they respond and why do they hate salespeople so much? And, you know, there's all this nuance. And so we have to be always curious about, you know, why people do things and teach it, which we don't do as often as we should.
And so my question immediately is, where do we start as teachers? Where do we start as students? If we want to really begin the understanding, it's really awareness of what areas of behavior, and I'm focusing on top of funnel, what areas of behavior should we really start understanding as sales professionals? And then how do we apply that to our sales conversation canvas based on the role of person we're trying to sell to? Because another thing I teach is we have multiple people that we meet at relative positions in the pipeline. Some let us in the door. Some are the actual decision maker. Some are going to be influencing the decision maker. So our talk tracks, each of those are different. Our language is different. And presumably the behavior of each of those is different. So as an instructor like you are with Cerebral Selling, if I came to you and said, okay, I'm throwing in the towel. I realize I've got to get this behavior understood so I could use it to my advantage. Where do we begin, David?
Yeah. So for me, there's two things that I would prescribe as the doctor here. Number one is a crash course on messaging, right? Making sure that your message is crisp and targeted and you can articulate it in the right way. And so there's lots of nuance to that. I get that. But messaging is really, really important so you don't get stuck in the sea of sameness. The other thing, which is just as important, is the delivery mechanism. So you could have the best email in the world, the best outreach in the world, the best message, but if no one cares to hear it and you're not able to get that message heard and through, then it's going to be useless. So the question is, how do you get that message across? You know, oftentimes it's, oh, I'm sending these amazing emails and the emails have all of this value and they have all of these great buzzwords and there's a this, there's a that. But oftentimes people don't read emails, right? And so thinking about creative things, I mean, it's funny, handwritten notes are making a comeback. Video is huge now in terms of open rates. Think like just wacky things. I mean, I've seen tons of these wacky ABM campaigns where people will send everything from little mini barbecues to little teeny tiny piñatas. You know, there's all sorts of tactics that we can use that are different, that are that we can use as a vehicle to get our message across. People, I mean, I think one of the reasons why video has been so successful is because people like to be entertained. You know, we all find ourselves sitting on our phones doing nothing in the time that we should actually be working, like looking through our Instagram feed or YouTube or what have you. You know, that could just as easily be watching a vendor, you know, deliver their pitch. You know, I probably wouldn't open a whole bunch of emails to read a whole bunch of pitches, but man, I'd open an email from Mary Lou with a video in it and see her fall on her face for 90 seconds and see, you know, see what that's like. So I think, and I'm just, of course, being facetious with you, Mary Lou, but the whole thing is I would focus on two things, which is what I do and teach is the messaging. And number two is the delivery mechanism. And it's not just the delivery mechanism trying to make it engaging, but also piggybacking on some very well understood psychological principles like reciprocity, you know, adding value first before making an ask. So those are the things I think a lot about.
I agree. I mean, I think, especially now that we have automated follow-up tools, sequencing, whatever you want to call it, we're able to line up what I call Lego blocks of messages from message 1 through message 8 and create a talk track or a playlist from that that allows us to have a conversation with the prospect. What we're seeing now and what you validated is the use of video does increase the response rate. Postcards inserted into the stream where you stop the sequence, mail the postcard, and maybe follow up on the postcard, or like you said, a thank you card where there's a soft close. There's not really a call to action on that. You're just being grateful. All those things help to mix it up and keep the prospect engaged and entertained in some cases. But I think, you know, the responsibility that this is putting on the sales rep now to come up with what these things are. And also, if you're in an organization where your sequences are dictated to you and you're just trying to follow up on the order in which someone else has set for you, makes it a little bit difficult.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, look, there's definitely a lot of room for improvisation and for reps to do the things that work for them. The challenge is also, I mean, every rep is different, right? You know, for some reps, getting on a video and doing some of these things are very second nature, others not so much. It also depends, to your point earlier, who you're selling into, not just the role, but sometimes even the geography. Right. Now, I used to manage teams in New York and Toronto and Atlanta with customers all along the East Coast, and the way that we interacted with each of those customers was very different. You know, the tactics could be different. So the one thing I actually do advocate for is this idea of never falling in love with your tactics. You know, this idea that we tried this thing, it works, so we're just going to keep spamming the crap out of that tactic until it stops working. You know, that's not the way to go. I'll tell you a story. I was at a conference in London in the fall, and a fellow was telling me a story about how one of his reps tried to get a deal closed at the end of the month by FaceTiming the customer while they were on vacation. Oh. And I'm like, oh. And you might have a visceral reaction. It sounds like you do to that particular tactic. Now, look, I don't know what the relationship was between the client and, you know, and the seller in this case, if that made sense. I do know that once you can get on a texting relationship with a client, that's fantastic, right? People pay attention to text. It's a lot better. But the FaceTime on vacation. And so on one hand, I have this hugely negative visceral reaction to, like, what would I like if I was on vacation? Would I like the seller to be pinging me? But on the other hand, I applaud the seller for trying something different, right? You know, whether you think that's overly aggressive or not, maybe they did have a great relationship. Maybe it was completely appropriate. But this idea that we always have to be trying new things, because as soon as we fall in love with something, it's going to stop working. And that's challenge we all find ourselves in.
Definitely. I mean, I came up in the direct mail era. And telephone, we had direct mail, period. That was most of the ways, and face-to-face, belly-to-belly, as I called it. And direct mail worked really well, and then it didn't. Now, all of a sudden, direct mail is coming back. So another thing to add on to what you're saying, David, is that it may not work today, but bring it back in a couple of years, because it may work again. Because people get used to following the wagon and doing the bell curve of everybody jumps on the bell curve and does a video from a year from now, maybe not the way to go. So you have to be very agile and nimble in the way that you communicate. And luckily, the tools we have out there give us that ability to sort of move things around and, you know, not have to, and it'll remember for us what we did 8, 10, 12 months ago, and what worked, what didn't, as long as we're tracking properly. So I think what I would really focus on of the two things you mentioned is the messaging piece first, so that you're really understanding what these playlists look like, what these talk track looks like. And also the other thing that I teach is relative position in the pipeline, because if we're doing targeted outreach, which is what I teach, then we have to worry about 5 levels of awareness that our prospects are in. They may not even be aware of who we are. So they're this unaware state of, I don't know you, I don't have a problem, you know, what is it that you're trying to talk to me about? And then we go from there to problem aware, where they know there's a problem, but they don't necessarily know a solution for the problem. All the way up to level 5, which is, I'm very aware, I'm most aware, I know you, and I'm willing to start the dialogue with you. So our messaging even has to take into account that in the buyer's head is in one of those 5 states. So we have to really understand how to language our conversation to not only hit them where they're at, but determine where they're at, but get them to move to that next level.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree with you. I have a little technique on my website where I kind of outline, it's actually a video. It's an article called Target Your Message with this amazingly simple technique, which describes exactly what you just said, which is there's, you know, think about your message as concentric rings. And as you get closer to the center, you get more to the kind of like the tangible, visceral, here's the business impact. And as you get to the outer rings, it's more like the how. And it's not that one is better than the other. I mean, you can chain these messages together, but you know, depending on who you're talking to, you know, you might choose one versus the other as a starting point.
Right. So that's another thing is that you can't be enamored with, are you going to help me? Can I talk to you? Can I get 15 minutes of your time? You have to really go in with, I'm not sure where we're at here, so I'm going to provide you with a lot of helpful information until you tell me and signal me where you're at. I'm going to make some assumptions about where you're at, but I'm not going to overwhelm you with where I think you should be, which is the biggest mistake I'm seeing now in a lot of these sequences. I've been tracking a sequence of late from a vendor who I love the vendor, but their email sequences are horrid, you know, and I'm just, so I wrote to the marketing guy. I'm like, have you seen your email messages that are coming out? Because it's all about, can you help me? Can I get to see you? Can I take 10 minutes of your time with no value as to why I should even do that?
Oh yeah. No, it's, that's amazing. Well, I mean, I'll tell you, I'll give you another tip, which we haven't talked about yet, but it ties in nicely with what you were mentioning before about what's old is new again. So it used to be when we used to book travel, with travel agents.
Right.
And then travel agents went away because the internet happened and we have all these travel options. What do we need travel agents anymore? We know what's up. Yeah. But what's happening now is that actually travel agents are making a comeback because there's too much choice. You know, we have, the Trivago guy. You guys have the Trivago guy in the States, right?
Do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the Trivago guy and it's a fear-based pitch. How do you know you're getting the best rate on the hotel? You can trust us. We'll aggregate it for you. Well, the data shows that the thing that people trust more than anything else is someone like themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, how can we mobilize the authentic voice of people like ourselves in the sales cycle? It's funny, when I launched my website and I needed a logo, I went to my buddy who had a logo designed for his website. And I said, who did you use? And he told me, and I just did that, right? Because I don't have time to look around. Now imagine you're reaching out to your prospects now, and you're trying to figure out what's the best wording and what's the best medium, because you're trying to break through as a stranger. I mean, we try to avoid the cold calls. We want to do the research and have all the context we can, but I guarantee there is someone that person is willing to listen to more than you, you know, AKA someone like them, that you could probably mobilize to deliver that message on your behalf. And so that's why we're seeing the rise of these review sites like the G2 Crowd and TrustRadius and Capterra and so on. And that's just one of the ways, right, that we can promote advocacy. But, you know, all of the data says that because I listen to someone that's like me, I think companies should be focused more and more on mobilizing those authentic voices as a tactic, which you don't see as much as you would expect to see these days,
no,
given how effective it is.
Referral systems are one of the areas that I look in first to see, especially if the client has a good customer base with a high, what we call NPS score, net promoter score, where there's a loyal client base in there. Activating a referral system that works on the loyal promoters. So for example, if they were to move jobs from company A to company B, then trigger those alerts that they've moved, because they're the best people to say, hey, now that you're over at XYZ company and you remember how great a job we did for you at ABC company, let's have a conversation when you're settled in about, you know, what it is that they're doing there and whether they can use our help. That whole conversation track, it doesn't exist in so many companies. It's just mind-boggling to me.
Oh yeah. Well, here's a great story of that I think ties a lot of that together. So there was a fellow who had a company who had a solution that did exactly what you described, which was, hey, David, wouldn't you like to know when one of your top customers leaves their company, goes to somewhere else, they can kind of get you supplanted there, and wouldn't you like to know when that happens? And at first I was thinking, well, doesn't LinkedIn tell me this? Can't I figure it out? Then, you know, he was saying, well, no, it's not really proactive in terms of telling you that. You can run reports and all these kinds of things. And so I said, hey, you know, this sounds interesting, but you know, call me back. Call me back later. I got more important things. So what he would do was he would periodically get, this is the ultimate. He was great. He would periodically get back to me. And instead of saying, hey, David, is it time yet? Does it make sense to chat? He would find examples of my customers that have moved from company to company, and he would bring them to me as gifts. Hey, David, I found Mary Lou, and she just left her company, went to this other company, thought you'd like to know, right? And I'm like, it's awesome because it's reciprocity. He's adding value. He's showcasing the value of his solution, right? And it's a huge, you know, back to, you know, the idea of advocacy. It's a huge play for me, huge value for me. So, yeah, I love that.
And that fits in line with your delivery mechanism. I mean, it's not only what you're delivering, where you're delivering, but the context around which you're delivering. So I think the two combinations of the messaging, also looking at the lead mix, you know, are you referral? Are you outreach specifically? Are you follow up on inbound? What is this conversation track that you're putting together? Once you tie all that together, and it's not very difficult, but once you tie it all together, you'll have a really good system that you can start pushing records through, so you have statistically relevant sample of what those conversation tracks did, how they performed, so then you can move things around later on. As you said, always be testing, which engineering,
that's right.
We're all about get your ego in your pocket, don't fall in love with your code, and make sure that it's performing, and then try to iterate, make it better with every statistically relevant piece of data that comes back to you. So sales is kind of the same way, right?
It's true. Look, that's the only way to do it. In fact, you know, what I find that people often miss in that equation is their existing customers. You know, we're so focused. The way I think about messaging so often is it's like clothes. So we get dressed. I don't know if I've used this expression with you before. So you're getting ready to go out. You're standing in front of the mirror. You're all dressed, ready to go. And you look at yourself and you say to yourself, I look good, right? I look good. I'm ready to go out. And I go out to wherever I'm going to the party and going to work. And then I realize that I'm dressed completely inappropriately for whatever it is I'm going to. But I thought I looked good when I was in the mirror. And oftentimes that's the way I feel about our messaging. You know, we do it in a lab environment and it sounds good, but either it falls flat or you go out to your existing customers and you say, hey, look, here's kind of what I, you know, believed the value of our solution was. What value are you seeing? And oftentimes they'll find there's a nuance in the value that they see that you don't see. And using those words, the words that your customers use, is very, very powerful. Even not just the actual words themselves, which are powerful in themselves, but even just articulating the fact that this is the value that our customers get. You know, hey, look, our customers tell us that A, B, and C. When I hire Mary Lou to train my sales team, here's the impact that they tell me they see, not that what I thought. Right. And so engaging your customers in that messaging, synthesis is really, really important.
Yeah, that's such a great point. I remember working with an accountant firm one time who insisted that they were back office accountants. That's how they defined themselves, described themselves, their behavior, their whole outlook, all their memos, everything talked about where back office accountants. So I said, okay, let's do this little study. Let's have a very short interview with some of your clients. I'll ask them two questions. You know, first one is, how do you describe ABC accounting firm? Not one person said, oh, they're our back office accountants. But the overall gist of how they described this firm was, they are an extension of our team. They're our business growth managers. We would be lost without them. That's a very different message than back office accountants. So we started changing all of our conversation tracks to include the extension of the team, the business manager growth, and wow, it made a big difference. And that's just because they saw themselves in a certain light and were very rigid about it, where their clients had a whole different view of who they were, how they served, what they meant to their progress as a company to grow. And it was painted a very different picture in the mind. So,
oh, yeah. Well, not only does that provide the clarity, like we talked about earlier, but there's an emotional connection that creates. So imagine, you know, if you said, so David, what is it that you do? And I said, you know, I didn't talk about, oh, I work on messaging and negotiation, objection handling, all that kind of stuff. And the why, I said, you know what I do? I train sales teams, but, you know, typically people come to me when they've tried all of the best and current sales methodologies out there, and they found that none of them work. None of them really speak to them or suit their business. Then they come to me. Now, I just made that up on the spot here just for fun. But the idea is like you're imagining, yeah, I can imagine this cohort of sad sales people who are just, you know, lamenting the fact that nothing's working anymore. David, please come help us. But it's just there's that emotion. So invoking emotion is very, very powerful as well. You know, in the introduction, as we negotiate, as we handle objections, you know, we like to think that we're all very logical beings, but we are much more governed by our emotions. So being able to invoke those emotions in everything we do in selling in an authentic way. I'm not saying Jedi mind tricks on people, certainly, but invoking the appropriate amount of emotion can be very, very powerful.
Definitely. So we're running close to end of time. The big message I got today was, you know, our love of learning, and that the sales machine is one that is constantly changing, that the constant in sales is change, and that there are really two ways for us to kind of start tackling how to have more authentic conversations. Top of funnel is where I'm talking. David obviously covers the whole thing, but it's looking at how we structure our messaging and how we deliver that messaging to prospects so that the end result is that we're getting more opportunities, we're having more authentic conversation, we're really learning about the value our prospect sees in us and clients. So, David, how do people get a hold of you to continue this love of learning and really work on, you know, improving their messaging? How should we reach you?
Yeah, well, the two best ways, first of all, check out the website, cerebralselling.com. I give everything away for free there, all of my articles, content, podcasts, videos, the whole thing. So by all means, avail yourself of that. You can certainly get in touch with me through the website, and you can also hit me up on LinkedIn. Very accessible there as well.
Okay, and I'll be sure, as everyone knows, to put on your page all these links. And I'll also make sure that I steer them towards that definition you had about the levels of awareness. So when we're offline, go ahead and send me that links to that one particular blog post, because I really hit that a lot of how to craft your messaging so that you're not making assumptions as to where people are in their head, but you're more trying to breadcrumb them to a place where they'll want to have a conversation with you. So forward that link over to me and I'll be sure to get it on the website. Other than that, thank you so much for your time. This was a great conversation, and I'm hoping that some of our folks here really take advantage and look you up and start a dialogue with you.
Oh, my pleasure, Mary Lou. Thanks so much for having me. This is fantastic.